you know, 1971 in March, and what was being recorded? Do we have something around that time that possibly would reflect the news of that era? Even if it's not digitized, we know that we have some things, and then as time allows and as budget allows, you know, because all this work is mostly driven by grant funds, then we can digitize and provide access to them to listeners.
No, yeah, but be able to tag it with,
You
know, what's the event being discussed? What mm-hmm. is a particular interest? What's the, again, what is the genre? If it's music, all of that stuff would be
right.
fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm building off what is currently being done in KBOO, you know, so it's not changing things. It's understanding the workflow here. It's understanding how programs are currently being described. So if you go to the website and it's program and I think it's genres and topics. So the topical subject terms are going to be included in the archival materials, the physical analog linear tapes, and the description comes from volunteer listening, you know. So volunteers, I know, are a great part of KBOO's work. You know, KBOO's come in, volunteers come in, they create shows, they record shows, you know. Like you said, they're ready to bring their stuff in when possible, and also to check content, you know.
Well, I think you can tell I'm really jazzed about this project, and I'm so excited that you're here to undertake it, because it's something we've needed for a very long time. Thank you again for coming in, and welcome to Portland and to KBOO. We've been speaking with Selena Chow, who's KBOO's new digital stewardship resident, and we will speak to you all next week.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Produced by Her, a screening of 4 documentaries that were made in the Produced by Her media program. The screening will be August 28th at 5 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The short films explore the commercial sexual exploitation of children in Oregon, the importance of safe space in the LGBTQ community, women and street art, and the experience of Black girls in Portland. Again, that's Produced by Her, a documentary screening, Sunday, August 28th at 5 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4111 Northeast Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. Time now is 6:02. Time for Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
It would have been better for me if I would have been able to go somewhere where they concentrated on helping me address my addiction issues than putting me in a cage.
The alternatives to prison are few and far between. And after serving time, the options for getting back on your feet are even worse. Finding food, a job, and a place to live with a criminal record can become almost impossible tasks.
We've got to build an underground railroad for people returning home from prison. And we've got to embrace those labeled criminals. Not necessarily all their behavior, but them.
On this edition, women building their own support network after being released from prison. We'll hear A New Way of Life and the New Underground Railroad, a documentary by Chris Moore Backman. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
My name is Susan Burton. I am the founder and executive director of A New Way of Life Reentry Project. The first house started in 1998. It started as my home with a desire to help those who were coming back after incarceration, help the women who were getting off the bus downtown Skid Row, totally unprepared to make a life. I figured if women had a safe place to go when they were released from prison, a place that they could call home, then the probability of them going back to prison would be lessened. And I found that to be real.
What must we do to build this movement that has been living in the hearts and souls of our people for so long? Well, first, we've got to start telling the truth. The whole truth. A truth born of deep and abiding love for all of us. Each and every one of us, including especially all those who have been locked up, locked out, ushered into a parallel social universe, stripped of basic civil and human rights, ushered into a permanent second-class status, all with the expectation that they will remain forgotten.
Sometimes people have fear of doing good when they're not used to it. They're used to failure. I'm not fearful of failure anymore.
I am so not alone. I mean, from Susan to her staff to the ladies that's here and the people that come in, it's awesome. It's awesome.
You know, oh God, I've just been in some crazy places. Nothing like this. I've never been in a place like this, you know, where people really care and people are really out there to help you.
In her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, Michelle Alexander describes the emergence of the largest prison system in human history. A prison system fueled by a decades-long war on drugs that has categorically failed to reduce both the presence of drugs and the prevalence of drug addiction in the United States. As Alexander explains, however, the drug war has very successfully supported the establishment of a prison industrial complex unparalleled across the globe and across history. A complex which, like its partner drug war, consistently targets poor people of color throughout the nation with far greater tenacity than white, more economically privileged communities. The fact that whites sell and use drugs at the same rate as black and brown people doesn't come to bear on the workings of this criminal justice drug war institution. Many are surprised to learn that women comprise the fastest growing segment of the U.S. prison population, the vast majority being impoverished black and Latina women ensnared by the drug war. In addition to raising consciousness about the reality of mass incarceration and the work of organizing for its abolition, Michelle Alexander identifies a third crucial area of work for those of us seeking a more human, more just future in the United States.
Just as in the days of slavery, when it was necessary for a network of committed souls to emerge who were willing, sometimes at great risk to themselves, to provide shelter and food and safe places for people who are making a break for freedom, today we need to provide that same kind of support. We need to have a network of families, of places of worship that are providing desperately needed support as people are struggling to survive, people who are willing to come together and provide safe places.
We're in South LA, 91st and Central Avenue, right bordering Watts, and we're at a New Way of Life Reentry Project where women coming from prison begin their new life. This is what we're talking about, the Underground Railroad, making the way, leading the path from incarceration and slavery to freedom and leadership. Yeah, so this is South LA, and we do have an ice cream truck coming down the street. Yeah, they're everywhere.
Anytime that I call her, Susan is like, hello, could I help you? What's the matter? Is something going on? She's always been there. And she always give us words of wisdom, words of respect, words of trying to do better for ourselves.
She stands up for what she believes in. She lets me know that I could really do something with myself, regardless of what my background has been. You know, that I can still be something.
Susan Burton's 5-year-old son was killed when he was struck by a car after running into the street. Grief-stricken, Burton turned to drugs, became addicted, got arrested for a nonviolent crime, and went to prison. She got out, but repeated the cycle again and again over the course of 15 years. Upon her release in 1997, at the age of 46, something shifted. A friend helped her find a job as a live-in caregiver for an elderly woman. She got into drug treatment and began rebuilding her life, eventually saving enough money to purchase a bungalow on a sunny street in South Los Angeles. Through the experience of overcoming the barriers placed in front of her because of her criminal history and the felon label she was forced to carry, Susan Burton felt called to the service of other women in the same situation. Service which eventually came to the attention of Michelle Alexander as she was writing The New Jim Crow.
I read about Susan when I was in the process of writing the book, actually. I read about her organization, A New Way of Life, and read an interview that she did about the work of supporting women returning home from prison and how demoralizing it is to constantly be faced with these signs saying, you are not welcome here. She talked about how on every job application, the signs appear. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? On every housing application, when you go to apply for food stamps, the signs are always there. You are not welcome. You are not wanted. And the importance of eliminating those signs and creating welcoming, safe places, as well as real pathways of opportunities for people who've been released from prison.
Hey, what you got? I see something behind you.
No, I don't.
Yes, I do.
Ah!
Yeah, look at you. What you got? Oreos.
Oreo here.
Say hi.
Hi, you already come here 2 times again.
Yeah. This is the 3rd time he's coming, yeah.
As young Soraya so enthusiastically pointed out, this wasn't my first visit to the house where A New Way of Life began. But this visit was my chance to get a house tour from Susan Burton.
So this was it. This was a spot where I lived and worked. This was my little corner. This was the birthing place of A New Way of Life. I had a little cot back there, and I had a file cabinet right here, and I had a desk right there, and this was it. I had 2 bunk beds in the front room, 1 bunk bed in the second bedroom, and 2 bunk beds in the back bedroom. There were 11 of us total, and we created community. We created support for one another. The women come here, women desperate for safety and security, and they find that where they can feel welcomed and feel ownership in where they're living, feel responsibility where they're living, and rise to that responsibility and begin to hope and begin to dream again.
Over 600 women have made their home at one of the 5 safe houses established by A New Way of Life. Of those, almost 80% have successfully discharged parole, maintain their sobriety, and not return to prison. Those newly released from incarceration need to assemble a complicated puzzle in order to achieve the stability that will allow them to escape the cycle of imprisonment. And each piece of that puzzle must be found, acquired, and kept in place in the face of all the barriers placed before those who carry the burdensome label of criminal or felon. Of all the puzzle pieces, the most essential are almost always employment, housing, and sobriety, each of which are at the core of a new way of life's advocacy work, in addition to many others.
I met Susan while I was there, while I was doing my intake, going in, and they was just telling me about the place. They was just telling me that we'll help you as a place to stay. We'll help you do your medical papers, get your Social Security card, get your driver's license. Take me back and forth to the places that I needed to go. And they was telling me about the meetings that we go to. And I never thought in my wildest dream that I would have been coming to this program. I just exhaled. It was like a burden just was lifting off me.
Slow down, there's nothing after you. Back down, there's nothing after you. Calm down, there's nothing after you, after you.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 510-251-1332, extension 108. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
There's nothing after you. There's nothing after you.
We now return to A New Way of Life and the New Underground Railroad, produced by Chris Moore Backman.
The worst part about being in prison for me was just the fact that I was just confined. I mean, because it's doable. You can survive. When you commit a crime, you just have to be accepting that, like, this is the situation that you got yourself into, so you just have to deal with it.
Do you think there could have been something else for you that would have been more helpful than prison?
Yes. I'm in a place right now that's...
I think it would have been better for me if I would have been given some opportunities to get at the root causes of what was going on with me. It would have been better for me if I would have been able to go somewhere where they concentrated on helping me address my addiction issues than putting me in a cage, than locking me up, handcuffing me, stripping me, demoralizing me.
My outlook on the situation is different, Ms. Burton, and I'm sorry for the simple fact that if you commit a crime, period. At one point in my life, I felt like because I couldn't stop using, the only way for me to stop was for me to be locked up. My first program, when somebody told me to go to a program, I said, that's not going to work for me because if I can walk out, I am going to walk out. So I ended up, like I said, committing crimes. My second charge was just I was on a high-speed chase on the freeway and crashed, and I could have killed some people because I was in my addiction, under the influence, and went and stole somebody's car and crashed. I could have took somebody's life. You know what I mean?
So I understand that. But again, I think about the root causes from the get-go. I mean, when you were going to school or when you were born or when you were thinking about what you want to do, it wasn't like, I want to be a drug addict. All the drugs that came into our communities, you know, I mean, what was that for? What was that for? And many of the crimes that are committed are crimes of poverty. People are driven to commit those crimes, and then somehow it becomes a way of life, and then we medicate the pain and the demoralization of where we're living from and how we're living with drugs and alcohol, and then we're incarcerated for that. But the root causes: poverty in America, lack of systems that function in poor communities, lack of resources in poor communities is the root problem. I'm sorry, but I just had to speak up, Mama. And you know, when you say people like Susan, but you're like Susan.
Oh, I said that to say people like you who are
people like
giving
you
opportunities and who stand up for
people
what you
like
believe
you
in, just
standing
like everything
up for what you believe in. People like
I
you.
I do.
Stand it up
and
for
I'm
what
learning
you
from
believe
you.
In.
I'm learning from you.
All right, we're going to get down to root causes, Mama.
Okay.
We're going to take responsibility for our actions, but we're going to understand what drove us to those actions. Got it? So there's something else probably could have been long before she hit that prison door. The ability of her parents to take her to swimming classes, or the ability of her parents to introduce her to some type of arts. A lot of other things that people with privilege would have gotten. A school system that operated differently from a place of punishment, or overcrowded classes and shabby classrooms, inadequate teaching tools. But be it that it didn't start there, she might have been able to get some therapy. She might have been able to access a drug treatment program. She might have been able to have adequate shelter, adequate food, things that make it possible for you to live, maybe not even from day to day, but maybe from year to year. Some sort of security that brought about a feeling of safety.
To start ending this us versus them, that we're going to help those criminals who aren't us. All of us are sinners. All of us have made mistakes. All of us are criminals. Question is, are we willing to still love one another despite our failings and our mistakes? Now, I want to be clear that when I'm talking about love, I'm not talking just about love for those people who have committed crimes like we may have committed, you know, crimes that we think not so bad. I'm talking about the kind of care and love that keeps on loving no matter who you are or what you have done. It's that kind of love that is needed to build this movement. We've got to build an underground railroad. We've got to build an underground railroad for people returning home from prison, helping to save people one by one, helping them find food and shelter and work. And we've got to embrace those labeled criminals, not necessarily all their behavior, but them.
Michelle Alexander points to the stigmatization of the imprisoned and formerly imprisoned as one of the biggest barriers facing the movement to end mass incarceration. I asked Susan Burton for her thoughts on that stigmatization.
There's so much judgment that goes on in the world in relation to people, period. But when it comes to people with a criminal conviction, the judgment gets really, really harsh. And I think what needs to happen is that we put judgment aside and help wherever and however we can. The reality is that people who have served time, whether I believe they should have served time or not, the reality is that the time should end. And the way society is constructed today, it never ends. The punishment goes on and on and on.
I felt that burden ever since day one that I was incarcerated. I feel that, okay, people are going to look at you different. people do look at you different when you are an offender. It don't matter what kind of offender you are. Sex offender, drug offender, theft. It doesn't matter. Being in prison, I am an offender.
It's sad, you know, because people do change. And they hold that over your head like that. But people do change. Because me, I've really changed. You know, I don't ever want to go back to prison. I did 3 years, and that was long enough for me. Having to be locked in a cell or doing slavery work for nothing. And just to be told when you can go eat and, you know, when you want to go to bed. And all that. I don't want to ever go through nothing like that again. I have prayed and asked God to help me to be humble, and I'm a humble person today.
October 2009, I was driving under the influence of PCP. My friend died that day. She was a good friend of mine, real good friend of mine. She had 4 kids. A lot of people kept saying that my life was spared. I'm like, you know what? I don't even know the meaning of that. I couldn't understand, like, why would God spare me to live on earth, you know, knowing what happened? How can I live with that? I forgive myself to a point where I know how to forgive people for doing things to me. I had to get that in my head and while I was in prison, because I couldn't come out more depressed than ever. And I don't mind talking about it, and it's easier when I keep talking about it than just holding it in. Afterwards, I always find a new understanding or peace.
Slow down. There's nothing after you. Back down. There's nothing after you. Calm down. There's nothing after you.
As the movement to end mass incarceration builds, a critical conversation is taking hold. History strongly suggests that it is crucial to the success of social movements that the people on whose behalf the movement speaks and acts need to themselves have a seat at the table when movement decisions are made and when the character and culture of the movement is developed. Michelle Alexander points out that the emerging Underground Railroad for newly released prisoners and their families is not only an example of necessary social work, it is a critical element in the overall strategy to dismantle the entire system of mass incarceration.
Can the Underground Railroad help to ensure that leadership emerges, continues to emerge, you know, from prisoners and formerly incarcerated folks? Absolutely. It is very difficult for people who are struggling literally to figure out where their next meal is coming from or where they're going to sleep. People need to have basic needs met in order for it even to be possible to contemplate devoting one's life to the service of others. It is my hope that by building this Underground Railroad and by working in partnership with people who have been directly impacted by this system, that we will build a movement in which the voices of those who have been harmed the most and who have suffered the most in the system are not only heard, but are helping to shine the way.
The morality of America needs to be awakened. The consciousness of how we think about people needs to be awakened. This class system needs to be shattered, that everybody looks at each other straight across, not down or up, that there's this regard,
human regard for one another. And there's this level of accountability for that. That when I see something or hear something, I don't lay dormant or silent. I step and speak to correct it. And that's some real work.
Susan Burton's voice sounds the twin resolve of a woman devoted to hands-on service and to movement leadership. Her example and the spirit of her work at A New Way of Life illustrate one of the most central and potent themes of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. Tinkering with the criminal justice machine, she argues, will never be enough to end mass incarceration. Cost-benefit reforms and piecemeal policy changes are not a foundation for truly transformational and structural change. On the contrary, a spiritual turning, a new embodiment of care, compassion, and concern in our society, is what Alexander argues is necessary. The simple yet profoundly challenging realization that we, each and all of us, belong to one another. Susan Burton and the women of A New Way of Life give us a picture of what that might look like.
You know, it's beautiful. I watch them going to school. I watch them with their children. I watch them with their disappointment. I watch them come in and say, you know, it worked, Miss Burton. Or it worked, Mama Sue. I got into school today. What you told me worked. And it's beautiful.